Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out.
Thanks for listening to the New Books in Jewish Studies podcast. I'm your host, David Gottlieb. My guest today is Jeffrey D. Clausen, Laurie and Eric Sklut Emerging Scholar in Jewish Studies and Assistant Professor of Religious Studies at Elon University. We're discussing his book, Sharing the Burden, Rabbi Simcha Zissel Ziv and the Path of Musar, published in 2015 by SUNY Press as part of its series in Contemporary Jewish Thought. In this work, Professor Clausen provides perhaps the most exhaustive biography to date of one of the most influential figures in Musar, the Jewish discipline for development of moral character. Simcha Zissel, also known as the Altar of Kelm, was not only a leading moral theorist in 19th century European Judaism. He was an influential educator, an impassioned public speaker, and a widely read student of classical and continental philosophy. Professor Clausen provides a critical exploration of Simcha Zissel's writings and of the virtue ethics contained therein. His book is a welcome and needed addition to the academic study of the Musar movement. Professor Clausen, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be in conversation with you.
So before we get into discussing the book itself, tell me about your academic interests and how you came to be interested in Musar as a subject for academic research.
So I'll answer that question by going back a little while. I first became interested in the study of Jewish ethics when I was an undergraduate at Carleton College in Minnesota, where I studied with Lewis Newman, who is a leading scholar of the history and theory of Jewish ethics. And the experience of studying with a scholar of Jewish ethics first inspired me to be more interested in Jewish studies and to think critically about Jewish thought and Jewish ethics. And in the course of my studies as an undergraduate, I first became really interested in questions about ways in which identities and religious practices shaped people's character and might make them into particular kinds of people. And that's an interest that really stuck with me from the beginning and is really at the core of this book. So when I was an undergraduate, I was interested in thinking about this in terms of Jewish practice. I was also somewhat interested academically in Buddhist practices, especially in how disciplines of meditation might shape practitioners. Mm-hmm. And I was also interested in ancient Greek philosophy. I was a classics major as an undergraduate with a particular interest in Plato. And I mentioned those early intellectual interests because all of these kinds of academic interests played a role in the topic that I eventually came to focus my doctoral research on some years later, Rabbi Simcha Zissel Ziv, the figure who's the subject of this book. He wrote a good deal about these very kinds of questions. He wrote about how Jewish practice might shape Jews into particular kinds of people with particular kinds of virtues. He wrote about how disciplines of meditation might shape practitioners. And he wrote a surprising amount about ancient Greek philosophy, which is one of the themes that I bring out in my book.
So it sounds almost as if your spiritual and intellectual interests aligned with his. Was his work the influence on you, or did you discover him as your interests developed?
Both. I first discovered Simcha Zissel Ziv and the movement that he was a part of, the Musar movement. I discovered that world when I was a student at the Jewish Theological Seminary, JTS. Mm-hmm. I'm a student in the JTS Rabbinical School and Graduate School. Mm-hmm. And in my second year there, I had the privilege of studying with Rabbi Ira Stone, a constructive Jewish theologian, right, who's also a scholar of Emmanuel Levinas and also of the Musar movement. I had the opportunity to take a seminar with Ira Stone focused entirely on the Musar movement. I was captivated by Simcha Zissel Ziv, by the Kelm School of Musar that he founded. And as I went on to do a PhD in Jewish thought at JTS, I eventually ended up focusing on him for my dissertation, and then this book emerged out of that dissertation research. And I have both, my interests have been shaped by that encounter, and for sure, that encounter interests as well.
So for those who may not be as familiar with the Musar movement as you are, can you give us a brief history of it, and standing on one foot, as it were, and of Rabbi Simcha Zisselziv's role in it?
Yes. So the Musar movement was an Orthodox movement in Lithuania in the middle of the 19th century, and it emerged under the leadership of Simcha Zissel's teacher, Rabbi Israel Salanter, who was focused on the goal of urging Jews to engage in Musar, to bring Musar, moral discipline, to their lives, to their souls. And his effort was in part a reaction against more liberalizing trends in the Jewish world, a reaction against the Haskalah, the Jewish Enlightenment, interested in cultivating a deep kind of piety that would passionately defend the kind of traditionalist values that Salanter saw as at the core of Jewish life. At the same time, he also
received some pushback from traditional Orthodoxy, didn't he? Didn't this movement face some opposition? Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. And at the same time that it was a movement that sought to sort of shore up the defenses of traditionalist Orthodoxy, mm-hmm. it was also, I think, a kind of reaction against traditional rabbinic Orthodox culture in Lithuania, especially a reaction against the sort of Talmud study focused culture that that had real cultural influence in that world. And part of Salanter's effort was to focus on virtue and the role of emotions in the moral life, and to focus on cultivating virtues, fear of God, reverence for God, equanimity, humility, honesty, generosity, loving kindness, virtues that in the thought of many traditionalist Lithuanian rabbinic thinkers would come naturally to Torah scholars without tremendous amounts of work. Salanter's insistence was that it would take a lot of work to develop such qualities, that developing such qualities is at the core of what he saw God as expecting human beings to do, and that developing those kinds of qualities, developing those virtues would take a lot of work, would take not just studying Talmud, but would take efforts of meditation and visualization and chanting, emotionally charged chanting, and studying Musar literature focused on the development of character, on moral virtues, and making real efforts to cultivate empathy, making efforts to perform deeds of loving kindness. And Salanter's contention, and this shows up as well in his senior student, Simcha Zisselziv, the subject of my book, thought that tremendous work was required in order to work on moral character.
It seems that part of what made Simcha Zissel a unique character, not only in the Musar movement of his day, but in Orthodox Judaism of the time, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that he was very well read in the Western philosophical tradition, and he taught this as part of a general studies curriculum in his Talmud Torah and Kelm. What was the genesis of the introduction of general studies? What led him to want to do this? And how controversial was this innovation?
Yeah, so this was certainly very controversial. And this helped to make Simcha Zissel something of an outlier within the Musar movement and really opposed by many other figures within the Musar movement. So other figures in the Musar movement, like other figures in traditionalist Lithuanian Orthodoxy, were staunchly opposed to the introduction of general studies in Jewish educational institutions. So things like the study of mathematics, the study of Russian language, even subjects like that were staunchly opposed by traditionalists. And the efforts of the Haskalah in the Russian Empire, of leaders of the Haskalah, were precisely to introduce subjects like that. By and large, the Musar movement resisted and was set on resisting that kind of curriculum. And so Simcha Zissel in founding an institution that did include such subjects, that did include the teaching of math and Russian language, and then through Russian, the study of world history and literature, and eventually German language mm-hmm. as well. That was really deeply controversial. This meant that it meant that non-Jewish Christian teachers were visiting the school that he founded every afternoon to spend 3 hours teaching these sorts of subjects. And
which, of course, was unheard of in a traditional, say, yeshiva.
Yes, mm-hmm. yes. Much of the opposition to Simcha Zissel's efforts, even within his own movement, were because of this. Mm-hmm. So he seemed to have a sense that, on the one hand, that engaging in such studies would be useful and would be economically useful, and he, more than other Musar movement figures, had a sense that engaging in commerce and seeking to learn trades would be a valuable activity for Jews in the Russian Empire in the late 19th century. He may have had political motivations as well, sort of wanting to train leaders who would be able to engage in good relations with the Russian government. But he also seems to have had a real sense that this kind of study would have some kind of moral benefits.
One thing I wanted to ask you about. Asking about the influence of the Western tradition on him, what lessons on moral excellence did Simcha Zissel derive from the Western philosophical tradition and not, say, from Jewish canon and Jewish text? And how did he square what he derived from the Western tradition with traditional Torah-based learning?
Yeah, so I actually don't think that he took up anything that was radically different from anything that or he didn't take up anything that strikes me as deeply contrary to things that he could have learned from more traditional Jewish sources. The motivation for having general studies at all seems to have been in part out of a sense. So the motivation beyond the economic and political kinds of reasons that I mentioned mm-hmm. seem to have been especially a sense that engaging with ones with sort of the needs of people around you, understanding people around you, understanding one's general culture has real value, not necessarily in and of itself as offering real content, but that one has a moral obligation to be involved in one's broader civilization. There's a lot. I think that Simcha Zissel was inspired in part by Samson Raphael Hirsch and the world of German neo-orthodoxy, and had a similar sense of sort of a cultured individual who should have some awareness, although on a lower level than was encouraged in neo-orthodoxy in Germany, should have some awareness of the broader society. Mm-hmm. There are truths also that that Simcha Zissel describes himself as arriving at, thanks to his study of Aristotle, for example. Mm-hmm. When he explains the concept of practical wisdom, for example, the idea that one should develop a virtue of being able to weigh advantages and disadvantages of any given path of action, that's an example of a place where he refers his readers to sort of the best source to study this is Aristotle's Ethics.
Interesting.
I think that's an example of something that he could have less easily found in a classical Jewish source.
He also, although I'm not, I didn't see this in the book, but a lot of what you describe of his moral and ethical orientation sounds very stoic in terms of a constant moral vigilance, an emphasis on lasting versus fleeting pleasures, and in fact of foregoing pleasure for the sake of morality. Were the Stoics an influence on him as well?
Not in any direct sense. His studies of Western philosophy or ancient Greek philosophy, I don't think were all that extensive. He clearly read Aristotle's Ethics mm-hmm. And had a copy of the Hebrew edition with a commentary by a figure from the Haskalah. He clearly had that volume. I don't think he had all that much else from sort of the world of Western philosophy. Okay. He does have Stoic aspects to him, and I especially noticed that in his focus on thinking that virtue is really what provides happiness, regardless of your material circumstances, as long as you have virtue, that leaves you in a place of that leaves you in the place where you should be.
Interesting, because one thing that struck me is not necessarily contradictory in his theology and his ethics, but one place that where there was a potential tension was, on the one hand, his belief that the Torah, you know, represented the epitome of rationality, and on the other hand, his belief that contemplation of punishment after death was the best incentive for upright moral behavior. So could you talk about whether and to what extent there was a tension between his theology and the influence of philosophy, and give us a sense of how it differed from traditional, say, Lithuanian Orthodoxy?
Yeah, well, that's a great example of the conflict that I think he definitely felt. So Symphysical stresses the idea that that virtue should be its own reward, and that one should not be motivated by fears of otherworldly punishments or promises of otherworldly rewards. And it's clear that sort of within his philosophical vision that's his ideal. Mm-hmm. And compared to Israel Salanter, compared to his teacher, he is much more focused on that ideal. Israel Salanter has more fire and brimstone sorts of teachings, more than Symphysical. Salanter had a real emphasis on the afterlife, but that is also still there in Symphysical. It's just that it's in tension with this focus on, it's in tension with his acknowledgement that sort of ultimately that should not be one's motivation.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that Symphysical saw, precisely because he saw human nature as so fragile, much more also than Aristotle did, mm-hmm. let's say, because he sees human nature as so fragile and he sees human beings as so easily swayed by their desires, precisely because of that, I think he saw it as essential to appeal to people's self-interest and to threaten people with fears of what might happen to them were they not to behave with moral uprightness. Uh-huh. In their lifetime. He does really view that as an important kind of Musar activity, to focus on what it would be like to be punished for your misdeeds. Mm-hmm. Even as I think he knows that that's not the ideal, he thinks that human beings need that kind of meditation.
Interesting. So there's also, it seems to me, an emphasis that you don't see in traditional Jewish praxis on contemplative practice. He is influenced, it seems, by the early texts of Musar, like Baya Ibn Pakuda, and his outlining of the problem of pizur ha-nefesh, the distraction or scattering of the soul. And he prescribes, I think, contemplative exercises as a way of stripping away materiality and developing equanimity. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. So those kinds of exercises are really also really central to Symphysical's system. So he recommends practices like holding on to just one thought and just keeping that one thought in mind and concentrating on that. Or especially, that shows up especially in his reflections on prayer and the necessity of engaging in prayer at a slow pace, davening slowly, taking each word for itself and pausing, mm-hmm. letting oneself focus and training one's mind in that kind of way. Or when sitting in the study hall, to train one's mind to just focus on what one is doing, and never to look at the window. That kind of practice. Okay. As well. There are lots of practices like that he imagines. There are particular kinds of meditations that he instructs his students to engage in. But sometimes they sometimes they're about not being distracted. Some meditations are about being distracted in a certain kind of way, in this, or being interrupted in a certain kind of way. Mm-hmm. And this is one thing that I do appreciate in Simcha Zuzel's teachings. So when he asks his students to model themselves on Abraham, the patriarch sitting at his tent and interrupting his own meditative activity in order to host the wayfarers who are passing by in order to feed them. That's a kind of meditation that he asks his students to engage in, where he asks them to precisely be willing to interrupt themselves at times of need for people in need. And he actually asks the students to imagine that you, my student, are sitting with the Vilna Gaon, with the greatest teacher, the greatest rabbi of our era, of the modern era, mm-hmm. and that you're immersed in study with the Vilna Gaon. It's the most amazing experience you could possibly have of study, right? That would be total bliss. Mm-hmm. And you should imagine what it's like to turn aside from that study because wayfarers have come by your tent and they're in need of being fed.
That's really interesting. And it's interesting, too, because he also depicts or seems to consider Abraham as chief of the philosophers.
Right.
As part of the theme of Torah being the epitome of rationality, he's influenced by Maimonides' view of the superb quality of Abraham's rationality and of Abraham as chief of the philosophers. So what led him to see Abraham that way, and how did that influence the curriculum at the Talmud Torah?
Yeah, so his vision of Abraham, I think, is really indebted to Maimonides, and he sees himself as following Maimonides in viewing Abraham as a philosophic figure par excellence. At the same time, so Abraham was able to sort of reach the to sort of discover the Torah for himself, as it were, with any external aids. Simcha Zuzel did not think that his students in his day or himself were at a level where it was at all possible to do that. And so in contrast to Abraham, who arrived by way of reason at profound truths about God, about human nature, about what it is to be in this world, in contrast to that, he did think that his students could not live by philosophy alone. Mm-hmm. And needed what Abraham didn't need, which is the revelation at Sinai, which is immersion in truths that were learned by Moses and the people of Israel at a particular moment in history when God revealed what Simcha Zuzel sees as the ultimate truth of the Torah to them.
Interesting. So it seems to me that there's, and your book makes clear that there is, a considerable tension between not only the study of philosophy and the study of Talmud, but between Aristotelian virtue ethics and Talmudic dialectics. So it seems to me that Simcha Zuzel is creating an enormous tension, not only in the wider Orthodox community because of his innovations, but he may be creating significant tensions in the minds of his students because sometimes these methods of instruction and thought are at odds with each other. So my question has really two parts. The second part, which I'll ask first, is about how this played in the wider Orthodox community. But the first and more significant question, I think, is how these tensions surfaced with his students. Did he face internal dissension amongst his students about his approach?
So he certainly did in various kinds of ways. On the question of philosophy, and I should emphasize that philosophy was not central to the curriculum of the Talmud Torah. Mm-hmm. There was this time for general studies, but that wasn't a time for, you know, the in-depth study of philosophy. That was, I think, often pretty basic, Russian language skills and basic math skills, not necessarily on the highest level. He did for sure, I think, when he spoke every evening, when he delivered his Musar talk that he delivered every day, he did invoke philosophers. But I don't want to give the impression that was sort of that central to his mm-hmm. to his teaching, okay. even as I think it's a striking and interesting piece of it. And it did spark dissension. one of his most famous students, Nathan Zvi Finkel, who was a student of his and then became a spiritual supervisor within his yeshiva, a mashgiach. Finkel then left behind the world of Kelm, left behind the world, left behind the institution that Simcha Zissel had founded to start his own yeshiva, the Slobodka Yeshiva, just a bit further away in Lithuania. And Finkel, although he was not totally upfront about this in his writings, he confided to others that he was dismayed by these efforts to mix in true Torah with non-Jewish teachings. And that may have been especially about the curricular choice to devote 3 hours every day to general studies. It may have also been about this reflex that his teacher had to, you know, regularly appeal to Aristotle or Plato or Socrates as well. So Finkel is a good example of a Musar movement figure who wanted to restore the study of Musar to something pure and free from the influence of non-Jewish sources. Simcha Zissel himself, though, also, whenever he praises Aristotle, he really almost always pivots and points out something that points to Aristotle's weakness in some level, that Aristotle was too focused on self-love, for example, or that Aristotle did pretty well in this. You know, it's worth looking at the ethics for this, but Aristotle did not have access to the perfect rational Torah that was revealed at Sinai.
Right.
And so you who are sitting here in the study hall, you have access to truths that Aristotle could never have known because you are heirs to this, the oral tradition that goes back to Sinai.
Interesting. What, in your estimation, has been the lasting influence of Simcha Zissel? Not only in terms of towering students of his own, like Rav Finkel, whom you just mentioned, or Eliyahu Dessler, who was a student of his, but how are his innovations still manifesting, if at all, in Jewish practice today?
Yeah. So part of the lasting influence of Simcha Zissel is the kind of model of practice that he offers, the model that he developed at his yeshiva of slowly working one's way through different sorts of character traits, taking a week or taking a month to focus on honesty, and then taking the next, let's say, month to focus on kindness, and the next month to focus on gratitude, and so on. That kind of model did take off within the Musar movement. And it continues to be seen in manifestations of Musar practice today, among various sorts of Jews who have taken up Musar practice. Much of that goes back to Simcha Zissel's kind of model, taking time to focus on different character traits, and then part of the model that Simcha Zissel developed was a model of students coming together to discuss their experience with the particular trait during the past month, and to spend some time engaged in meditation together, in study and conversation, in chanting, and in taking on other kinds of exercises or assignments that would be appropriate for that particular character trait. I do think that Simcha Zissel's focus on loving kindness and generosity has also had some real effect. You see that in students, including Eliyahu Dessler, who you mentioned, who also places a real emphasis on a kind of love that's focused on generosity. Mm-hmm. So those are some of the ways in which he's been deeply influential.
So in reading the book, in looking at your bibliography, and in trying to find other academic texts on the study and history of Musar, it doesn't seem like, certainly academic works have been written. There have been books written especially about Israel Salanter, the founder of the modern Musar movement. But it didn't look to me as though there have been a great deal of academic texts on the history or influence or trajectory of the Musar movement. If is this the case, and what academic works did influence you or direct you in this work?
There have been there were two major works written on Salanter that that did help to get me interested in the subject here and did help to direct me. One of which is by Emmanuel Etkus on Rabbi Israel Salanter and the Musar Movement. Mm-hmm. Second of which is by Hillel Goldberg, which came out of a dissertation at Brandeis. And a third book that really does, or a third dissertation that really does trace the influence of the Musar Movement that really shaped me a lot, is Tamar Ross, the Israeli philosopher. Mm-hmm. She wrote her dissertation on a range of Musar Movement figures, including Salanter and including Simcha Sissel, and also including a number of other figures from the following generations. And she inspired me in large part, especially her effort was to bring these figures into, to subject them to some philosophical analysis.
Uh-huh.
And that really inspired me in thinking that it was possible to think about these figures who were not philosophers in a conventional sense, who were totally unsystematic in their writings, but whom I sensed there was something philosophical there. And Tamar Ross really inspired me to take that seriously, to take seriously the possibility that philosophical ideas could be located within this kind of discourse.
And finally, tell us what projects you're working on now and what you hope to be focusing on in upcoming works of yours.
So I've continued on in my scholarship with the theme of Musar, but I'm now writing about Musar much more broadly than just as a phenomenon confined to the Musar movement. So I'm now working on a volume which is titled Modern Musar, Contested Virtues in Jewish Thought. And that's a volume in which I'm thinking about Musar literature broadly. Musar literature is literature that describes, that explains virtues. And I'm looking at diverse ways in which various virtues have been described and explained by diverse modern Jews. So there is virtue-centered literature that's been produced by modern Jews, certainly not just within the Musar movement, which took this legacy especially seriously, but within nearly every Jewish movement and within nearly every modern Jewish framework imaginable. And the goal of this project is to collect different examples of modern Musar literature that really show disagreements and tensions and debates in how different Jews think about common virtues. The book is organized around a series of virtues that are widely praised, but are praised in very different ways by different Jews. So virtues like compassion and gratitude and humility and honesty and self-control. I want readers to be able to see that Jews have meant radically different things when they encourage such virtues. And looking at Musar, looking at virtues, is a great way to understand the vast diversity of modern Jewish ethics.
That sounds like something that I will greatly look forward to reading, and I hope you'll let us know when it's available in print. We're out of time. I want to thank you for talking about this fascinating book on Simcha Sissel Zviv, who is a fascinating character in the history of Jewish philosophy and practice. My guest today has been Jeffrey D. Clausen, Laurie and Eric Sklut, Emerging Scholar in Jewish Studies and Assistant Professor of Religious Studies at Elon University, and we've been discussing his book, Sharing the Burden, Rabbi Simcha Sissel Zviv and the Path of Musar, published in 2015 by SUNY Press. Professor Clausen, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much.